From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope, senior lecturer at the Graduate School of Education, and Dan Schwartz, dean, professor, and czar of the School of Education. I can say that because Denise is on assignment, and we have a substitute teacher host, Dr. Marilee Apezzo. Dr. Apezzo was chosen for this role because she has a very, very successful TED presentation on walking in creativity, and she was a guest on this show, and it's like one of the number one watch shows. So welcome, Dr. Apezzo.
Thank you so much, Dan. Anyone who's ever been a substitute teacher knows that this is like the hardest job on earth.
Our guest is already sort of trying to sneak away and get out of class.
I promise I won't be as difficult.
I didn't show up for you.
I want to change the order a little bit because I want Professor Bromley to be able to weigh in on what happens next. So today we're talking to Patricia Bromley. She's a professor of education at Stanford, and her research spans a range of fields, including organization theory, comparative education, sociology of education. She's also interested in minority and human rights, nonprofits, civil society, and globalization. So I'm feeling pretty small, but thank you for joining us, Patricia.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here with you guys.
So have you ever looked back at textbooks from earlier times and sort of looked, boy, things have changed?
Yes, I have actually. Back when cattle farmers ruled the world, nutrition textbooks actually had the four food groups. And two of them, shocking, were meat and dairy. So lots has changed.
So how many food groups are there now?
17. No.
There's gluten. There's gluten-free.
There's the microbiome diet. So, Dan, what about you?
Thank you for asking.
Have you ever looked at textbooks and seen differences over the years?
I have. So for no particular reason, I went back and looked at primary school math textbooks. And so I've got a sampling of like the first chapter from each one. This one's from like 100 years ago.
Wait, are you going to test my math skills?
I think you're going to handle this.
Oh, no.
So this is like from 100 years ago. Article 1, a unit is a single thing. Thus, 1, a house, a chair, are units. 2, a number is a unit or collection of units. Thus, 1, 4, 7 are numbers. So that's like 100 years ago. Very definitional. This is closer to, say, 70 years ago. It's the same intro. Hold up your right hand. Hold up your left hand. How many hands have you? Place your right hand behind you. So you can sort of see pedagogies are changing, right? It's like a little more interactive.
It's a little bit like Twister.
Yeah. So this one, I think, is probably from the later 50s. And again, it's a math textbook. This is how it starts.
Okay.
Man's progress. What is the difference between modern man and primitive man? Primitive man had to hunt for his food. He could travel only on foot or in his clumsy boat. Modern man has machines to produce his food. Steamships, airplanes, it goes on. Primitive man had only crude stone tools to aid him to his work. Modern man has thousands of ingenious tools to make his work easy. Another kind of tool, and a most useful one, arithmetic, was unknown to primitive man.
That's hilarious.
It's sort of stunning
to see
these changes and sort of the messages, both the pedagogy and the theory about how you learn math from like raising your hands to learning definitions, but also the
building the clumsy boat.
Yeah, no, it was a little harsh on primitive man. You know, I think primitive man deserves some respect.
Yeah. Primitive man's not very happy
about
that.
If they weren't there, we wouldn't be here. So why is this relevant to our guest? Is that Patricia has done studies of how textbooks reflect societies. I think that's going to be our opening topic.
So how do textbooks reflect these changes in views about civic participation in your past?
So the examples Dan gave are great. That was really helpful and compelling. And especially the last one you raised about primitive societies and how those kinds of assumptions are embedded in the knowledge in textbooks is exactly the kind of thing I pick out. So he's raising this important point that you can look at it in all kinds of subjects, So math, it's a great one, science textbooks, literacy textbooks. And I look at this around the world, and a literacy textbook from Afghanistan, for example, used to teach the letters using things like J is for jihad. It was trying to send the message embedded in the learning, bigger kinds of social norms beyond just the learning, so the literacy and numeracy.
So it's not just social studies where you see enculturation.
Right. Math textbooks in a lot of the Arab world use things like how many missiles do you need to achieve this or that. So it's really embedded in all subjects.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really shocking.
Teaching of their culture. Not really stealth, teaching of the culture.
So can you imagine that? Like, so we're in an urban school and our math lessons involve bullets.
Right.
That's a stark
comparison to the Twister game that you read us.
The way I try to look at it is actually those things are embedded in our current textbooks. But it becomes more shocking if you look across countries or over time because it's not the culture we take for granted now. It's hard to see those things because we think it's normal.
So what do you think is an example of our missiles that we don't see?
So I was really struck by a conversation with my son the other day about exactly this kind of issue of he's talking about something they're learning in school about sex education and says after puberty week at school, one of the students says they think they're transgender. I said, oh, that's really interesting. What do you think about that? How do you feel? And he recites back what sounds like what they get taught in school, which is, that's fine with me. It doesn't affect anything to do with my life. I'm happy for them to live how they want and I'll live how I want, which in some ways sounds fine, maybe, but there are a lot of ways schools could teach about issues like that. So it could be more as an ally rather than distant, for example.
Right. So can you, looking across nations in their textbooks and their time periods, looking at a textbook, can you make some inference about the political system they have? Can you tell? Like U.S. textbooks are all about fairness. No, that's stupid. You come up with the example.
Yeah, absolutely. You can tell. You can see a range of things that are more or less accepted. And I look specifically around these issues of rights and how different kinds of groups are talked about. So U.S. textbooks do tend to have a particular view of fairness, which is about individual rights, freedom to not be interfered with, basically. And other societies might have a much stronger sense of group rights is a common contrast, or no rights of people. Maybe all the rights are held by the state. There's lots of variation. So something that always stands out in my mind is an example from Canada where something that's in all the textbooks there is this famous court battle about a Sikh student wearing a ceremonial dagger to school, which here seems very shocking in the U.S. But the way that's taught about in Canada is it was a violation of his religious rights for the school to try to prevent that. And that's what the constitution, the courts there upheld. So it is allowed in Canada because the group religious right is strongly protected.
Wow. So we're here with Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Marilee Opezzo. We're speaking with Patricia Bromley about how textbooks can actually be a mirror to the culture or a vehicle teaching the culture in which the textbooks exist in.
I don't have an accent. Other people have an accent. Right. It's very hard for me to hear my own accent, although clearly I must have one. So I'm looking at textbooks. Is there any way for me to be able to see these sort of bias? I don't know if they're bias leanings in the textbook, or is this, you sort of have to make comparisons. You have to go look at what other nations do to be able to detect that these kinds of things are sitting in there.
Yeah, for me, the comparisons are a way to at first see the differences. And then bias is such a loaded word.
Yeah, that requires a bad choice.
It's interesting, though, because then we get into an ethical conversation about what do we as a society want the standard to be? And that's a more normative discussion that isn't automatically present in the books themselves. But it's a really important conversation as a society to be having.
If I understand correctly, some body makes a set of standards. And so everybody should learn algebra and these 20 components, or everybody should learn about the Civil War or something like that. And then textbook writers try to execute on that. And that's where these hidden values show up It's in the textbook writers, as opposed to the standards, which are sort of explicit value neutral statements, or?
No, they're certainly embedded in the standards as well.
Okay.
Some of my favorites to look at are the Texas standards for history and social sciences. That, for example, at the state standard level, suggests that Moses' influence on the founding documents of the country should be discussed as part of the core curricula. So no other states have that as part of their standards for discussing the founding fathers.
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
So it's embedded from the top down.
I'm just imagining the room in which these people are trying to decide these standards.
Right.
And the argument over, should Moses be drawn in? Wow.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, they're highly political.
Yeah.
But then but as a teacher at my level, like, what would I mean, I choose my own textbook to some degree to based on the company that decides to give me the free textbooks. So how is there enough variability for me to pick one that's more or less sort of, I don't know if we're going to use the word biased, but, you know, dictated by the standards?
Teachers have a lot of autonomy, I think, in how they decide to treat the material in the textbooks. I don't think we can ever get outside a system where the books aren't representing some kind of values. They can represent different sorts of values and ones we decide to call better and worse. And I think there should be conversations about that. So teachers can, with any book, have those kinds of conversations.
Right.
But they always have values embedded in them. There's in history, social sciences, at least.
So Article 1, a unit is a single thing.
What's the value
thus
there?
One, a house, a chair. No, there's a value.
The chair. It didn't use other nouns, right? A BMW
missile. So if you look, take China. China has gone through tremendous changes. Do their textbooks sort of reflect those changes? Like, if you were to look at them, you'd see now they're more entrepreneurial or capitalist, for example.
Yes, absolutely. There's huge changes in China and other countries we might think of as being like China in terms of undergoing huge social, cultural, political transformations, economic, over the last few decades. There are often moments in time with the collapse of the Soviet Union or China no longer being ruled by the Chinese Communist Party in the way it was under Mao. Overhauls of the education system, and especially changing textbooks, are often a centerpiece of how new regimes seek to roll out what they're trying to do in the country. So at a lot of these important political breakpoints, there be a whole curricular revision from top to bottom in the entire education system. It can go both directions. So it's been increasingly what we might think of as liberal and progressive around the world, more about human rights, more about minority rights. But the world is at a different place in the last decade, especially. And we're starting to see some transitions the other direction. So Hungary, for example, is currently revising their whole curricular structure, redoing all their textbooks in a deform or going back the other direction.
Wow.
So this is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Mary Lee Opezzo, and we're speaking with Patricia Bromley about how textbooks can reflect changes in the societies which they're made in.
And drive them. It sounds, now that you say it, it's obvious. If I want to use an explicit tool to change people's views, where do people spend more time? Formative years. They're in school for hour after hour. You know, I could go through the church, and that works pretty well. But the school, they're there, and there's compliance. And
I think it's very powerful in a couple of ways. Partly, it may change the way kids think internally, but it also has this representation of a highly legitimate form of knowledge. So even if people agree or disagree internally, they know it's the right answer, in quotations, from the state or the government or some more powerful authority is saying this is legitimate knowledge.
This is a little tangential. Do we still have to pledge allegiance to the flag? Is that gone away? Is that a reflective of times, or it's just people are too busy to do it? Or
I think we do.
Okay. We'll ask our fact checkers.
My son knows the Pledge of Allegiance anyway.
Yeah.
So I was so shocked when I realized this. But
wow. That's
I believe we do.
That's stunning. So how do you stay up on the all the changes in all the countries and their textbooks? I mean, that just seems like
you have a big dashboard.
Right, you're like, oh, Hungary just made some changes. I'm going to be,
ding.
Right.
I have a big vision for all of the changes in all of the subjects and things I would like to keep track of. I don't quite manage all of that. I really love it when people send me a lot of examples now, helps a lot.
So they know Trish is going to want this.
Yes. So I get sent lots of things about changes going on around the U.S. and around the world.
So how did you do this work? When you started, would you get like digital copies and then have a computer go find words like human rights? Or you're sitting there reading the Hungarian textbook with the translator next to you? And how did you do this?
So part of the big vision would be it would be great to have digitized textbooks. And I'm working with some computer scientists now to put together some standardized tools so that textbook researchers could do that. But it hasn't been historically the way that work has been done. So it's literally what you're describing of sitting in a room with a bunch of people who speak other languages and the books.
Wow.
And going through with them.
I believe you've done over 1,000 books.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Yes, I've looked at a lot of textbooks,
but
there are way more than that.
No, I know, but you've read all those textbooks. You must be the world's expert on the subject matter of history or science because you've been reading all these textbooks.
Right.
I've seen a lot of textbooks.
Oh my gosh, yeah. The human natural language processor we have here with us is Patricia Bromley. This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Mary Leo Pezzo. More with Tricia next on Sirius XM Insight 121.
We translate the research we know about best practices with school, curriculum, and parenting to teachers, administrators, parents, and youth.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Mary Leo Pezzo. We're talking with Patricia Bromley about all things textbooks and how they drive society and society can drive them. Patricia, this has been so cool. So you mentioned that people send you examples of different content displaying different cultures from different textbooks. I'd love to hear more of those.
Sure. Oh my gosh, where to start? I have so many.
Science.
Okay.
Does this work if I do it that way by subject area?
Sure. So it's not science textbooks per se, but I'm thinking of some examples about the environment and environmentalism that have been really striking to me lately. One, because that's an area where the national citizen just disappears in most countries around the world, which in the textbooks I'm looking at, they're about national identity. So it's very striking that discussions of global citizenship and environmental protection are globalized, whereas other things are not necessarily. So there's all these discussions in textbooks all around the world about how protecting the environment makes you a good global citizen, and that's very recent, only since the 90s.
Oh, so everyone has that.
A lot of countries, and some go very far. So there are a few constitutions around the world now that have been revised so that Mother Earth or parts of the natural earth have rights in the constitution, the way organizations do in U.S. law, for example. So that gets talked about of the rights of the earth.
Wow.
In like Bolivia, for example.
Wow, that's interesting.
It is. It's very different in some ways than the kind of recycle, reduce, reuse that we have here.
Right.
Yeah, treating the earth as a living being that it is.
Yeah, so as I said, I don't have an accent. But when I sort of hear these different points of view, I suddenly realize, boy,
right.
do I have a point of view that I was unaware that was handed to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love it for that it helps me see the things I didn't know I believed.
Huh. Yeah, God, it's got to be infinite. This is something I said before on this show, and I was unhappy with how I explained it. Mm. So I tried it at Stanford graduation. I tried to say it a different way. It was our graduation recently. Go alumni.
Congratulations to everyone who graduated. Yeah. How many hands did you shake?
I shake every single graduating student's hands, and then I go use a lot of Purell.
Oh, right.
I douse myself in Purell.
But. You haven't fist bumped them. You're still shaking their hands.
No, and it's the same thing. Sorry, this is tangential. But, you know, it's on a stage in front of their families, and, you know, there's like 800 people there.
Yeah.
And they're walking across the stage, and they get the hood put on them, and then they come.
It's a big deal.
Yeah, and they come to shake my hand, and I say something to them. And no one has ever remembered what I said to them because they're just worried about they're going to trip on stage, you know. They turn around and they see all those people.
You're like sock puppets. Yeah. They're like, great, thank you.
Okay, so anyway, I tried to say it differently at graduation. And so as part of trying to help them understand why education is unique, I pointed out that education's sort of a unique social enterprise to do good in that it embraces all types of people and all histories, yet it tries to change them, right? And so I think this is sort of the fundamental tension that sits on a lot of things and where we have difficult discussions. So back to you, Patricia, in our time machine away from graduation. So how should schools teach about, say, citizenship and national identity when there isn't a shared national cultural or history? Like, yeah. Should I try and indoctrinate them to one thing, or?
It's worth thinking about the assumptions that are embedded in your question, even.
It's her question.
Yeah, no. Right. But my assumptions, yeah. I forced on him.
So the question suggests there is no national identity, which I'm not sure everyone would agree with. I just took the citizenship test on Tuesday.
No way.
This is a big part of what I study, too, and there are all these discussions around maybe all civics students should be required to pass the citizenship test,
what
for example.
What is on the citizenship test?
Everyone could pass it. So it doesn't
like
seem...
what colors are in the flag? Like what?
The idea behind it is that there's a shared knowledge that in 100 questions that is... national identity, or the important elements of it, at least.
Harder than the driver's test?
Oh.
Sorry.
What's the national equivalent of parallel parking?
This is what I do for a living, and I still spent a day or two studying.
Oh, okay. So, okay.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
I really didn't want to get it wrong. I felt like I could see some embarrassing news headline somewhere of like, civics professor fails citizenship test. So,
oh my goodness.
But I think that governments do believe and want to perpetuate a national identity. So we might, as people in the classroom, not think that one exists, but the idea is there that there is some shared national identity. So the books are really trying to navigate this difficult tension of there are many differences between people and groups of people, and yet we still believe countries exist, and that means something.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Mary Lee Opezzo, and we're speaking with Tricia Bromley, how she rocked the citizenship test as a person who studies this for a living, and that there is some idea of what national identity means.
So what are some aspects of national identity that rise above differences at the cultural level or historical experience?
Yeah, so two that jump out in the U.S. context are, as an example from the citizenship test and shows up in the textbooks, is what is the economic system of the country? This is a civics question.
Pop quiz.
But yeah, do you guys want to answer?
Yeah,
I think
Dan,
we can get it.
What is?
What is the economic system?
The rich get richer.
No. That's not correct. I would not be allowed to become a citizen with that answer.
Oh my goodness. So it wasn't an open-ended question.
No. Capitalism or market economy. So that and democracy. So these two values, they're high level, but they are present throughout. And there are other ways of organizing economies and societies, for example. But at that high level, they really believe every American should deeply believe in these values.
Wow. And there's 100 questions, so are 75 of them the answer is democracy?
70 of them the answer might be the president.
Oh, okay.
Who can do this, who can do that, the president, the president, the president.
Got it. Yeah. Wow.
But
so, it's the democracy, yet there's socialism is always around the corner.
One question is also, what was the biggest threat during the Cold War? So also who the enemies are.
Oh.
Is often a part of citizenship narratives.
Wow.
Yeah. So was there a textbook associated with this test?
There is a study booklet, yes.
And could you look at it and sort of just see case after case where they're injecting values beyond just what they're saying, but even in the way they're saying it?
Absolutely, yeah. Throughout. And so several states now require this sort of fixed set of knowledge as part of graduation requirements, at least to take the test. And it's
my gosh.
So it's really embedded in the school systems as well. But it's kind of a controversial way to think about civic values because of when you boil it down to 100 facts or something without adding some kind of reflection on what values they are talking about or skills you might want citizens to have, we might be missing something.
Tests always botch it.
Right. Right.
They're always such a thin slice of what you care about.
I mean, did you know to graduate kindergarten, you have to know how to skip?
Really?
Yeah. So that's one of the arbitrarily defined standards.
No,
you have to be able to skip.
Democracy, capitalism, skipping.
Skipping. Exactly. Very important. And why?
It's not a bad country. Those are the three. I feel pretty good about that.
So do you ever look at these textbooks and sort of say, they blew it? They're promoting values. It's going to backfire. They said it the wrong way. Or generally this democracy, capitalism, it just comes through so clear. It's hard for them to make a mistake when that's the culture, the air, everything they breathe. And
no, you can see ways it's really marginalizing to lots of groups of people. An American book, one of the examples was they're talking about the economic system. This makes it problematic, and then discuss workers who were brought to the U.S. to help with the cotton industry.
Wow. Oh, my goodness.
Which is so just, I mean, wrong and
right.
alienating
right.
and creates resistance to what might be an okay set of values under some circumstances, but it
wow.
just problematic.
Yeah.
Gosh, what an interesting world that I didn't even know existed about so much assumptions and values built into textbooks and how they reflect different cultures. Tricia Bromley, thank you so much for coming today. It's been really great to speak with you. Thank you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Mary Lee Opezzo. If you missed any part of this episode, you can listen anytime on demand with SiriusXM app, iTunes, and SoundCloud. Thanks so much.
Great. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. It was really interesting.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.